Thank you for downloading this podcast of Neil Carter talking about football manager Frank Buckley at MMU's Institute for Performance Research Symposium on Sporting Lives, held on December the 4th, 2010.
Just to start, in many ways, doing this paper, it was a kind of opportunity to look again at the stuff I'd done on football managers previously, and also I think coming back to it in conjunction with research I've done recently on coaching, on sports medicine, I've revised some of the material or kind of looking at this material in a different way. So in that sense it's good, but in many ways I'm still thinking about what new angles that can come out from looking at Frank Buckley and his career in management. Anyway, I'll start. On the 22nd of December 1964, as you can see there, the main headline on the back page of the Wolverhampton Express and Star just read simply, "The Major is Dead." And for the paper's readers, there was obviously no further explanation deemed necessary to who this person was and his impact on not only Wolverhampton Wanderers, for which he was a manager from 1927 to 1944, but also the people of Wolverhampton themselves. Although we should remember that during his tenure as manager, actually Wolves never won a trophy. They nearly won the double in 1939, coming second in the league and runners up in the cup. The golden era of Wolves, as you know, was the 1950s when the manager was Stan Cullis, who was actually a protege of Buckley. But I think the point is, of course, is that 20 years after his death, that his presence and his legacy was still being felt, and it was fixed in the minds of the memories in the memories and minds of the fans of Wolves. In addition to the local paper, he had an obituary in the Times. And that day, other obituaries included, there were two scientists and an important Scotland Yard policeman. He was good at fingerprints, apparently. And then there was the obituary for Buckley. And I think this is significant for a number of reasons, the Times obituary. I mean, first, I think it reflected now football's position as status as the national game, which had taken over cricket in the early post-war period. And it also highlighted not only the growing importance ascribed to the position of the manager within football, but also its visibility within popular culture more generally, which I'll touch upon later. And of course, it just illustrated the importance of Buckley himself, who in the Times obituary was described, amongst other things, as a pioneer in modern training methods and someone who had an uncommon flair for public relations. Okay, so that's kind of an introduction. So what I want to really do is try and consider why Buckley was this important figure in football, and importantly, in what context his managerial career developed. Firstly, just have a brief look at his career, both as a player and a manager. Now, as a player, we can see he had a relatively successful career, first with Villa, after he bought himself out of the army. He then went on to win one cap for England, which Robin has already mentioned today. The famous or perhaps lucky 3-0 win for Ireland at Ayrton Park in 1914. and going on to his managerial career, you can see how it stretched for over a 36-year period. But here I'm going to mainly talking about Wolves. So how did his career develop? Well, one way to look at it is to think about what models of football management were there at the time. And really, there were none really to follow. Training was basically on the job. So we might ask, to what extent did his background shape his career in terms of ideas and approach? Well, perhaps one way of looking at it is to look at his military career. Buckley was a soldier in the 2nd Battalion of the King's Liverpool Regiment from 1900 to 1903. He didn't actually see any active service, but unsurprisingly, he was very good at sport, represented the regimental football team. He reached the rank of Land Sergeant. But perhaps more significantly, he also qualified as a gymnastics instructor, which probably gave him understanding of training, physical fitness, and also ideas about instruction. I'm not saying these were the sole reasons for what shaped his future career, but certainly you could argue that it formed a basis for that. In addition, in the First World War, he joined the Footballers' Battalion. He was later wounded at the Somme and just discharged. And he also he tried to fiddle his pension actually later on. But that's another story. But because of his previous military experience in the Footballers' Battalion, Buckley was ordered a commission. And he eventually reached the rank of major, although it was actually only a temporary title. But nevertheless, he retained it for the rest of his life. And it became a kind of sobriquet, but one that virtually everyone else, including his wife, referred to him by. And as we know, army life was generally based on hierarchy and run through strict discipline. And again, I think this was later reflected in how Buckley ran his football clubs. Anyway, despite this military image, Buckley's career also needs to be seen in light of football's prevailing management culture. In general, football managers in this period were not the all-powerful figures that we know today. For a start, they were generally known as secretary managers who combined responsibilities for the admin's responsibilities with those for the team. More importantly, also, a manager deferred to his directors on playing matters in many cases. Directors had the final word on team selection and recruitment. By the 1930s, though, the stature of the manager began to rise, and this was really due to one person, and you probably all can guess his name. That's Herbert Chapman. And his success at Arsenal pointed towards the future model for managers, who now had the power to pick the team, decide tactics, and to buy players. Kind of Chapman was unique in many ways because he was at Arsenal, which was situated in London, which is very prosperous at the time, while much of the country suffered during the Depression. And by contrast, Wolves was a provincial club and lacked Arsenal's financial clout. Now, Wolves, the directors, they expected the manager, Buckley, to keep a tight rein on its finances. And Buckley was very good at this, very good in wheeling and dealing in the transfer market. However, although he was appointed in 1927, it wasn't until 1933 that the directors, and reluctantly, bestowed upon him the sole powers over team selection. So I think that's an important thing to get across, and it's always an important shift in a important moment in a football club's history when the manager gets sole powers to pick the team. So with the removal of these shackles, Buckley was able to put more of his ideas into practice. One of his important legacies was actually the creation of a youth policy, which was to be the forerunner for clubs such as Manchester United in the 1950s. However, he also had a focus on young players. And at one point at the club in 1937, Wolves didn't have one married man amongst the 40 players on their books. And this focus on youth also reflected how he managed players. It was claimed, for example, that Buckley wanted to know when and who a player was going to marry. So this again highlights a kind of obsessive nature about his managerial style. And people have talked about him as being the embodiment of the military model of management. He had a very military-like persona when it came to handling players. People talk of him as a martinet. And he had these very strict rules for players. They couldn't go dancing after a Wednesday night. And he also had a network of spies around Wolverhampton to keep tabs, basically, on the players, making sure that, you know, that they weren't breaking any curfews, and make sure they were behaving themselves. And unsurprisingly, perhaps, he was also an early practitioner of the hairdryer treatment to conjure up the figure of Alex Ferguson. When he was at Blackpool, for example, the supporters club had complained that the players had lost their enjoyment of the game because of his authoritarian manner, and that this was the reason for the team's lack of success. And there's other examples of this particular style. But also, it also reflected the highly masculine world of professional football generally, you know, that placed emphasis on these attributes of, you know, hardness and stamina, courage and loyalty. Now, I just want to talk a bit about the innovations that we can attribute to Buckley in terms of coaching, particularly in such as training and preparation of players. We've talked a bit about this already. There was very little coaching going on in England until the 30s. Training at football clubs was usually a combination of lapping, head tennis, and sometimes a bit of five-a-side. So there was this popular saying that during the week footballers would be denied any training with the ball because it was believed that they would be hungrier for it on a Saturday. And of course, when it got to Saturday, they didn't know what to do with it. Then this was ironic in a way, because by the interwar period, as Robin was talking about, I mean, European footballers were benefiting from the coaching by British players. Buckley, on the other hand, like Chapman, he was one of the few who'd recognised the benefits of coaching much earlier. And he'd done this at Blackpool, and he continued to do this at Wolves. And when he was at Wolves, he also introduced some mechanical innovations to supplement training sessions. He used a rowing machine, was an early example, and there's also here on this picture a machine purpose-built that fired out footballs at different angles for players to control. As you can see, they're all looking completely bemused at wondering what's going on. A room under the stand was fitted with rubber walls at which players would kick the ball and then it would return at unpredictable angles. I mean, the aim, of course, was trying to improve their ball control. But he had some also peculiar ideas, you could say. One of them was to encourage players to go ballroom dancing. Not after Wednesdays, of course, but because he believed that this would improve their balance and movement. And on occasions, he would insist on players dancing with each other in training. But there's a kind of method in his madness, you could argue, because he was very keen that all players, including goalkeepers, should be able to kick proficiently with both feet. And in practice matches, he'd have right wingers playing on the left, and vice versa. in a way, the overall aim was that he wanted the players to be versatile and would play them in a number of different positions. Moreover, I think another point as well. Now Buckley, remember, he's the one who's deciding he's the one with the power to pick the team. He's now deciding the tactics. And you could argue that Wolves' tactics reflected Buckley's personality, i.e. direct. There was little close interpassing. Instead, the accent was on attacking high-speed football, kind of what Dill was referring to regarding KG Hunt. Some might call it long ball, kick and rush. But because of Buckley's training methods, his teams are also renowned for their high levels of fitness. And to take advantage of the stamina, Buckley regularly flooded the pitch before every home game, which would put their Wolves players at an advantage. He claimed, though, that a softer pitch would lead to fewer injuries. Another major characteristic of the Wolves' style under Buckley was its emphasis on the physical. There was a saying when you come up against Wolves that it was easier to play against 9 or 10 than 11. That was Buckley's philosophy. As Thomas Hobbes might have said, for an opponent against Wolves under Buckley, it could be nasty, brutish and short. He also was unafraid to experiment with emerging scientific ideas in order to, you know, find an edge for the team over his competitors. Psychology was one area where he experimented. He took a player on one occasion to a local psychologist. In many ways, I think this reflected a form of COD psychology that was popular during this period. And a number of clubs had taken their players to psychologists, if you're going to call them that. The use of ergogenic aids was also becoming increasingly common in other sports, and this reflected the emergence of a discipline of exercise physiology. And this is obviously this is ultraviolet light rays used to speed up recovery from injuries. There's also chemical stimulants being used in other sports, and football was no different. Buckley had given players a pet pill before a tie when he was at Blackpool. However, of course, as I've mentioned in the title, Buckley was perhaps best known for what was known as the monkey gland affair, in which he was accused of injecting Wolves players with a form of gland treatment in order to improve their performance. And this caused a big stir in football, some claiming it was immoral, some were saying it's a form of doping. One famous player was quoted as saying, "We're not blooming guinea pigs." The implantation of monkey glands, it had been popularised by a Russian, Serge Voronov, in the 20s. He claimed that the injection of testicular implants would rejuvenate the patient. It's a kind of alternative medicine, really, and yeah, very alternative. Yes, but it was something that took place in the medical marketplace, really, and which was really open to fads, and this was kind of one of them. The main idea behind the use, it was said, was to prevent staleness within the players, as well as to improve their mental speed, stamina, physical fitness and resistance to illness. However, because of the improved form of Wolves, other clubs also began to experiment with gland treatment, including Portsmouth and Tottenham. This is Portsmouth here, actually. I didn't go a picture for Wolves. I mean, the picture is nonsense, really. It's just a fabrication for the media. And ironically, the 1939 FA Cup final was contested by both Wolves and Portsmouth. And unsurprisingly, it's since become known as the Monkey Gland Final, which Portsmouth won 4-1. Other clubs used it but weren't successful. Chelsea were relegation bound in this season. And 12 of their players volunteered to undergo the treatment, but after they were relegated, they came off it. And later, the FA had a conference and decreed that while the treatment was permissible, individual players had the right to refuse it. And it kind of cost £9.39, and after the war, it didn't raise its head again, really. Or that particular form of treatment, anyway. To kind of end, what I wanted to do was with the monkey gland affair, and perhaps also with recent debate about a methodology, is to try and show how significant a figure a manager Buckley had become, and how this had taken place. And of course, in the 30s. There had been a big expansion in the tabloid press, and there was this growing populist tone in its reporting, I mean, exemplified by the Daily Mirror. Increasingly, a proficiency in public relations was part of a manager's job. It had the aim of drumming up publicity by keeping the club's name in the paper. Chapman has certainly recognised this at Arsenal, and also his successor, George Allison, who was the BBC's first football commentator. And Buckley was more aware than most. So he set out to use the media for this purpose of creating sensationalist headlines. And with regards to the monkey gland affair, he claimed that some of his players had gained weight, but less likely that some of them had grown taller as a result of taking the treatment. And this kind of created a sensational headline in the news of the world. What this meant was that through the close relationship with the press, football managers were now becoming part of the story. As newspapers reported on the actions of clubs in terms of managerial activity. Previously, it was directors. Although we should remind ourselves that the press constructed reality as well as reflecting it, and that the powers that the managers held didn't always reflect the media's perception of these powers. And I think that's probably something that is still true today. But also, through the media, Buckley was able to cultivate his own mythology and aura by this relationship with the media. And again, like I said, it's been an ongoing process ever since. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Neil.